From the Land Grant University in Urbana-Champaign, Illinois, this is the Closing Market Report. It is the third day of June 2010. I'm Todd Gleason. In a few moments, we'll talk about the commodity markets with Dan Zwicker of ADM Grain Group. He's in Decatur, Illinois. In agricultural news, CFTC has launched a review of its own ability to enforce speculative limits. A Republican thinks it would be a good idea to cut greenhouse gas emissions, but not to the level proposed by President Obama. And the UNFAS expects world cereals production this season to rise to record levels. We'll have details of these and other stories shortly. Also this half hour, we'll hear a commentary from the Farm Bureau. In the second half hour of our program, on many of these stations and always online at willag.org, in that second half hour, we'll talk today with Andy Levine of the American Seed Trade Association. Have you stopped to think about what will happen when the patent on Roundup Ready One technology expires in 2014? Andy Levine has, and so have we. We'll ask him about it during The Farming World. And in just 26 minutes, right here on the Closing Market Report, we'll talk with the folks at Chesapeake Energy to discuss the global agricultural weather forecast. Pete Levitt is away on this Thursday afternoon. The Closing Market Report is a production of Illinois Public Media.
The Closing Market Report on Illinois Public Media is made possible with support from L&M Commodities, a full-service brokerage company serving area farmers with professional market advice and crop insurance products. L&M Commodities has offices in New Market, Indiana, Leland, Illinois, and Terrell, Arkansas.
In Chicago on this Thursday afternoon, futures finished the day like this. The nearby contract in the soft red winter wheat, July, a 441 and three quarter settlement price at lead option and harvest month, down three quarters of a cent. September, 459 and a quarter, down a penny on the day. And December, soft red, 490 and three quarters of a cent lower. In Kansas City, July, hard red, a 471 and a half settlement price, down 2 1/4 cents. Back in Chicago from the CME Group, July corn, 349 and a half, up a penny. September, 359 and a half, three quarters higher. December at 370 and a quarter, up a half. And the March corn, 383 and a half, up 1/4. May contract of next year, 392 and 3/4, up a half cent. July soybeans, 955, 22 and a half higher. August at 937 and 3/4, up 17 and a half. And the November beans at 919 and 3/4, up 16 and a quarter. Meal at 284, 1260 higher. Oil at 3766, up 24. June live cattle at 9210, a nickel higher. The August feeders at 109.67 and a half, up 2 1/2. And June lean hog futures at $80.45, down 87 and a half cents on a Thursday afternoon. You're listening to the Closing Market Report. Here's what the outside markets look like at this hour. July crude oil futures, $74.44 a barrel, $1.58 higher. June ethanol at $1.59.5, down a half a cent. Natural gas at $4.69, that's 26 6/10 higher. Heating oil or diesel fuel at $2.35, up 2 9/10 cents. And the gold futures at $1,208.30. A settlement price there down $12.30. The Dow now at 10,246 is down 2.8 on the afternoon. And the Goldman Sachs at 489.74 is 6.67 higher for the day. Here's what the weather forecast for the two-state region and the Midwest looks like. Scattered showers, a few thunderstorms, some seasonable temperatures will prevail over the coming 5 to 7 days. Favorable fieldwork conditions will occur between those showers. No general soaking of rain is anticipated, but a few locally intense thunderstorms are possible into early next week. Daily temperatures will be in the 70s and the low 80s with a few upper 60s in the far north. High pressure ridge should build into the Plain State during the mid to late part of next week. That high pressure ridge may move into the heart of the Midwest after June the 12th for some possible warmer and drier based conditions. Late season planting will advance with those periodic showers. Wind should be light, favoring spraying conditions, but the risk of thunderstorms will be hindrance to some of those operations. We'll take a complete look at the agricultural weather forecast when we get to the bottom of the hour. Pete Levitt is out of the office this afternoon. The folks at Chesapeake Energy in Chicago, high above the skyline there in the Boeing building, have agreed to be with us, so stay with us. That'll happen at just about 20 minutes from this point.
agricultural programming is made possible by Farm Credit Services of Illinois. Farm Credit Services of Illinois has been providing for farmers' credit and insurance needs for over 90 years, including real estate, operating and machinery loans, crop and life insurance protection, and programs for young and beginning farmers.
Todd Gleason's services are made available to WILL by University of Illinois Extension.
On this Thursday afternoon, you're listening to the Closing Market Report. It's time to check in on the agricultural futures markets. Dan Zwicker of ADM Grain Group in Decatur, Illinois, is with us. Good afternoon to you, Dan.
Good afternoon, Todd.
I bet the charts look kind of interesting in both the corn and the beans after the big kind of drop we've had. And then we turned around with the soybeans and rallied them pretty nicely today.
Soybeans looks real well. We had a week reversal here a week ago. Then we had, of course, that scary break here on Tuesday, and then follow through there on Wednesday. And now today we've turned around and reversed back. So on the July beans, it took out last week's high. So from a technical perspective, it does look like maybe this dip down underneath the uptrend line on July beans connecting the February lows here with the mid-March lows was a bear trap. So you have the bear trapped now, and now the market's in position here to put together a recovery rally. Very similar type formation situation probably on the November beans. Prices did dip down underneath the uptrend line here for the past 2 weeks. And now with today's close, we've closed back above that uptrend line. So you could maybe also view this as a bear trap, the bearishness of the last 2 weeks.
Can you find fundamentals to support this? We know, of course, that Brazil and Argentina harvested, South America in general, harvested a fairly large crop. Though they haven't been movers of that. We're not short of soybeans, I don't think, in the United States. There has been a lot of export business to China, though we have a fairly large carryout. And it appears there should be a fairly large carryout for next year. What's happening with this marketplace?
Well, if you listen to the market tells you that old crop cash inventory is very hard to find. And that is what's the key driving force here. Of today's rally, the basis levels are on fire. You've got a little bit of export demand picked up. You've got some pretty good crush people that need to kind of buy some inventory for processing and crushing. So it's real hard to find old crop soybeans. And July is the one that's kind of the driving force here, because what you're going to see is people buy July futures and stand in for delivery. So that rallies the July, and then that just kind of fuels the short covering in your back end months. And then you've got the technical action is supportive toward the market having put in some kind of low here and due for a corrective rally of the big decline that we've had here basically during April and May. So you get a couple combinations going together, and this is where we're at.
Okay, well, let me ask it a different way. Is it the fact that the beans aren't there, or that just everybody happens to be a tight holder at the same time?
Well, it could be a little bit of both. You don't know. What the technicals tell you, and this is why we study technicals, is to get ahead of the fundamentals before the news is out. It also could be telling you that while we have favorable growing weather right now, 2 weeks from now it may not be favorable growing weather. So the technicals are, at least chart action here, is suggesting that prices got cheap enough for now. And now we're going to be entering the key growing season here over the next 90 days. We don't necessarily know what the total impact of the oil spill down in the Gulf. If that continues to leak for another couple months, and then we get a hurricane, we could have a lot of oil spread out all over the lower Midwest. what kind of impact that may have to crop prospects, crop conditions, crop quality. So there's enough unknowns out there that I think end users are at least taking a position that it's maybe time to own some inventory.
On the corn side, when you look at the lead option chart there, a nice little daily at least hook up, right?
Yeah, we do have a little hook up. It's coming off of new lows for the decline or for the year. If there's anything that's somewhat generally positive I see in the corn futures chart or December corn futures, we could be what I call tracing out a broadening bottom type formation, with each drive down here having made a lower low, and then we've got a series of higher highs on the top side. So we have kind of a reverse pennant type formation, which could be signaling that the market might be trying to carve out some kind of pre-growing season rally here, or pre-July-August type low in here in the marketplace. But if you look at your daily continuation chart, we haven't done anything basically since the end of January. You know, we had the big bearish January crop report. Prices dipped down below the or went sharply lower after that crop report, and we had a low down here around the 345 area, and then we rallied back to the 381. So we've kind of stayed in a sideways trading pattern between 380 and 343 on the downside, and the midpoint of that is about 362. And this week we dipped down below the midpoint, so now we've tested the bottom end of that trading range, and so far it looks like we found fairly good support.
Do you believe it?
I think we're in a window here that you have to be a little careful of being too bearish. Granted, we've got a nice crop coming at us, and there's nothing that you can really see at the moment that would probably negate a big crop. But I've over the years, I've always watched weather patterns going into the first day of each season and see if there are any kind of clues as to whether or not that's going to be the dominant pattern for that season. So I see these computer models wanting to put a high-pressure ridge in the weather forecast 10 days down the road, and so that's getting awfully close to the first day of summer. So I'm kind of careful, at least at that point, to see what kind of summer weather pattern sets up before I would get real bearish or bullish at this point.
What do you hear out of the Gulf and potential problems that this widening oil gusher might have?
Well, I mean, the biggest problem, at least in the short run, of course, from a shipping industry, a guy gets a little nervous. I mean, if a ship goes through that oily waters, they're going to have to pull over. They're going to have to get scrubbed. They're going to have to get washed up before they move on up into the Mississippi, before they unload. So that could become a problem for exporters and importers of goods. You can hear about any story you want, I suppose. I mean, I think, you know, that it is quite obvious that BP's got their hands full, and it's questionable whether or not they will be able to survive this. I understand they are already offering out assets to generate cash, so they're in a big problem. Hopefully they can maybe this latest attempt cap the well, but I think the odds are against that, at least for right now, and about the only real chance of stopping it is going to be a relief well, and that doesn't really come online until about August. So it looks like we could have quite a pool of oil sitting down in the Gulf here by the time August gets around.
Just a bit of time left. Why don't you take up the dollar for me and its performance so far this year?
Well, the dollar, at least in the short run here, if you look at a daily chart, you can kind of see it's kind of run into a brick wall of resistance around this 87.46, 87.45, 87.47 was a high here earlier this week. So we've kind of got a triple top there. And then if you look along the bottom part, each low has been a little higher. So what I would call this is a rising wedge formation. And the width of this rising wedge is somewhere around $2.50 or so, or 2.5 points. If we break to the upside, and I mean penetrate this 87.47, 87.50 area, the chart people are going to be looking at a quick move up to this 89.90 area on the chart. Now, when you apply that then back to a monthly chart, that tells you that you're going to see a move above a neckline of a big head and shoulders bottom formation on the monthly chart, and that then opens up a long-term move to like 108. So it does look like the dollar is going to strengthen versus its index. Now, the problem is the index is the index, and it's, remember, it's weighted about 60% euro. So if you would have a total collapse of the euro and these European countries would go back to their own currency, then this index would have to be redone and reweighted. So maybe a lot of this stuff that we're looking at on the index is, you know, may not even be around by the time some of those objectives are penciled out. But there is no doubt about it that the foreign countries are at least in worse shape than we are right now. That's the problem. Is the dollar strong? It's not strong because of a strong fiscal policy or monetary policy. It's strong because the other world's fiscal and monetary policies are in shambles, more shambles than what ours is. So that's why you've seen a big movement in world traders to gold. Whether or not you like it or not, is still perceived as something of value that you can go any place in the world and exchange it for the local currency and go out and buy groceries with it. So that's why you're seeing a lot of movement toward gold and precious metals as kind of a reserve currency until the world bankers kind of get everything sorted out in here, Todd.
Dan, thanks so much.
Very well.
Dan Zwicker is with ADM Grain Group. You're listening to Illinois Public Media and the Closing Market Report. Dave Dickey is here now with a look at today's agricultural news.
In agricultural news, the Commodity Futures Trading Commission's internal watchdog has launched a review of the agency's market surveillance operations to determine how well the CFTC enforces speculative limits for large traders. The independent review was disclosed by the CFTC's Inspector General in the semi-annual report to Congress. The review will look at how effective the agency's staff has been in working with exchanges to get large traders to reduce the size of their contract holdings as the contracts approach expiration. The review will also examine how well CFTC staff has documented these discussions with the traders. A senior Republican in the U.S. Senate next week will propose energy and climate legislation that aims to cut emissions of planet-warming gases, but with far lower goals than President Barack Obama seeks. Indiana Senator Richard Lugar is crafting legislation he says would achieve about half of the 17% cut from 2005 levels in carbon emissions by 2020 proposed by the president. Lugar's legislation would cut U.S. greenhouse gas emissions through a mix of better fuel efficiency for vehicles, using more renewable fuels for those cars, making better homes and commercial buildings more energy efficient, and expanding nuclear power generation. The United Nations Food and Agriculture Organization says that world cereals output is expected to rise this year to near record levels, swelling overall supplies and putting pressure on already weakened prices. Overall, cereals output is seen rising 1.2% to 2.280 billion tons on the back of a 1.4% gain in coarse grains output. A 0.9% fall in wheat output this year is expected to be almost entirely offset by larger opening stocks. World prices of key food staples have dropped in the first 5 months of 2010, driven by falls in sugar and cereals. The FAO's food price index fell to 164 points in May from 174 points in January, off its 214-point peak in the spring of 2008. South Korea today upgraded its export growth forecast for this year to over 20%, as it saw the global economy improving faster than expected despite the Eurozone's fiscal crisis. The country's imports are also seen growing faster than previously forecast on a strong recovery in Asia's fourth-largest economy. South Korea plans to announce exact revised targets around the end of this month. And that's a look at today's agricultural news.
Hey, thanks, Dave. Dave Dickey is Director of Agricultural Programming for Illinois Public Media. That's public radio for the farming world.
Support for the Closing Market Report comes from AgriGold Hybrids, featuring the AgriGold Giants, a group of five new hybrids designed to meet the performance standards of yield, health, and consistency required by Midwestern corn growers. More information is at AgriGoldGiants.com or at 800-262-7333.
In today's listener opinion forum, Shelby County Farm Bureau's Amy Rochkus takes up the estate tax again.
For most farmers, providing the country's food, fiber, and fuel is not just about making a living. It's our way of life, a way of life we like to nurture, like our plants and animals, with the intention of passing it on to our children, grandchildren, and generations into the future. For some farm families, federal estate taxes can mean their most recent harvest will be their last. Estate taxes owed to the federal government by a farm owner's surviving family members can hit farm families harder than other small business owners because 84% of our assets are real estate based. When Uncle Sam comes to pay his respects, surviving family members without enough cash on hand may be forced to sell land, buildings, or equipment they need to keep their operations going. In these circumstances, farm families' heartache is felt well beyond the borders of our operations, as the rural communities and the businesses we support also suffer when farms downsize or disappear. And farmland close to urban centers is often lost forever to development when estate taxes force farm families to sell off land to pay the taxes. A higher exemption and lower rates will give farmers a better chance to remain in operation when transferring the farm from one generation to the next. This is why Farm Bureau is calling on Congress to provide a permanent estate tax provision that would increase the exemption level to $5 million with an adjustment for inflation. Also, reduce the maximum rate to 35%. A vote for estate tax relief is not only a vote for grain and livestock farms in Illinois, it's also one for the Chicago family sitting down to dinner tonight. This is Amy Rochkus with the Shelby County Farm Bureau.
Amy Rochkus' comments are her own and they reflect her opinions. They do not necessarily reflect those of this station. We strongly urge listeners like you to become involved by sharing your views as well. To do so, just give us a call. The number is 217-333-9697. You are listening to the Closing Market Report. It is a production of Illinois Public Media. Back in 2 minutes with the agricultural weather forecast.
This is Illinois Public Media Director of Agricultural Programming, Dave Dickey. In business news, finance officials from leading advanced and emerging countries began talks today on reshaping the global economic system to prevent a debilitating crisis like the one that took the world to the brink of a depression in 2008. The gathering brings together rich countries like the United States, Japan, and Germany, emerging powers like China, and developing countries like Indonesia and South Africa. Ministers are trying to shore up confidence in the markets and in the $1 trillion bailout plan for ailing European economies. Costco says it saw May sales in stores open at least a year rise 9%. For the 4 weeks ending May 30th, the company says its net sales rose 11% to $6.09 billion from the previous year. Including the benefit from the inflation in gasoline prices and strengthening foreign currencies, Costco said same-store sales at U.S. locations climbed 7%, while international sales jumped 17%. U.S. investment bank J.P. Morgan Securities Limited has been fined a record $49.12 billion in Britain, issuing a stark warning to other banks operating in Britain. The country's financial services authority says that J.P. Morgan has failed to adequately protect client money of between $1.9 billion and $23 billion between November of 2002 and July of 2009. And that's a look at today's business news.
You're listening to the Closing Market Report from Illinois Public Media. It is a Thursday afternoon. Pete Labbitt is away today, but Josh Darr is with us. He's with Chesapeake Energy, setting high above the Chicago skyline in the Boeing building. Is it cloudy where you are?
It is gorgeous this afternoon after a bit of a stormy day yesterday. So.
Oh, well, that's nice. We still have overcast skies here in our part of the world. Might we get something a little better than that?
Well, I'll tell you what, it is going to be a little bit of a stormy pattern here through the next 7 days, and specifically what we have is we have the ridge of high pressure. The summer ridge will be building over the desert southwest and then moving into the southern plains early next week, and what that does is sets up an active jet stream pattern across the northern third of the U.S., which includes Illinois, and so the next opportunity for rainfall here is late Friday afternoon. We get another punch on Saturday afternoon, Saturday night into Sunday morning, and then a third punch of rain coming across the belt here into central Illinois and central portion of the Midwest Tuesday night, Wednesday. So we have a couple rain producers ahead here over the next 7 days.
How widespread will these rainfall be, and in what kinds of amounts?
Good question. Generally, the further north you go across the belt, the better the chances for any one of these events. And they'll generally be in the range of 0.4 to 1.25 inches with some isolated heavier amounts with each event. And again, the further north you go across the belt, that's the most active corridor, let's put it this way, will be I-80 and north in each one of these events over the next three through next Wednesday.
There's been a kind of a hot spot in the southwestern plains. Have you been keeping track of it?
Yes, certainly well above normal temperatures in that part of the area, and actually go even further south into Texas and Louisiana, and they're starting to dry up. Some pretty good 30- and 60-day rainfall deficits building across that area. That's going to help build the heat in the southern U.S. here over the next week. And then you look out beyond a week, and that heat starts to come more prominently into the Midwest after our third rainfall event next Wednesday. We could start seeing 90s again across all of Illinois, and the majority of the Midwest as warmth surges up into the plains and then pushes east as we get into the weekend of the 13th, 14th, and beyond. So wet period here this week. Then we look to some heat the following week, week two of the forecast here today.
Is that a pretty typical pattern where it's sort of the heat begins in the southern plains and then drifts northward into the Midwest?
Yeah, that's a good source region for our warmer-than-normal periods during the summer. Is you get the heat building south, and then it evacs or moves towards Illinois and towards the Great Lakes, and that's when we tend to get our warmer-than-normal periods.
Our Chinese counterparts, farmers there, have had kind of a rough season so far. Is it getting any better for them?
Well, it is looking like first it was cold, then it was wetness, and now it looks like you're actually entering a drier-than-normal period, which will be beneficial for a time here, but if we continue that trend until later into June, and actually looks like you start to build some heat into northern portions of China later in June, that could be something to watch as we get into the heart of the season in July.
All right. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks, Todd.
That is Josh Garr. He's with Chesapeake Energy in Chicago, Illinois. He joins us here on the Closing Mark Report on a Thursday afternoon. Stay with us if you can. This afternoon during the Farming World, we'll talk with Andy Levine of the American Seed Trade Association. You can always hear it on our website at willag.org. I'm Todd Gleason. You have a good afternoon.
Support for WILL comes from Stuart Peterson, since 1985 offering strategic commodity consulting and marketing services to help producers manage market opportunities and risks by developing dynamic strategies customized to each client's goals and operation size. More information is at stuart-peterson.com.
This is the Farming World News and Interviews from the Land Grant in Urbana-Champaign. I'm University of Illinois Extension's Todd Gleason. Today, we'll talk about the American Seed Trade Association. Andy Levine is the CEO and president of that organization and joins us by phone. Thank you so much for being with us. Mr. Levine, can you tell me what the mission of the American Seed Trade Association might be?
Well, first, Todd, it's great to be with you today and appreciate the opportunity to join you and your listeners on the radio today. American Seed Trade Association was is a 127-year-old association that was formed to be an effective voice of action on matters concerning the development and marketing and movement of seed and seed products and services throughout the U.S. and ultimately throughout the world. We work to promote the development of better seed, to produce better crops for better quality of life.
Who are your members?
Our members are quite broad. We essentially like to say that we represent the commodity from alfalfa to zucchini and everything in between. Our members are major corporations and small, medium-sized companies across the U.S., that produce row crop seeds, vegetable seeds, turf and forage seeds, flower seeds, essentially anything for planting. And we range from the conventional producers to biotech and organic producers.
Are you a lobbying organization?
We are. We help lobby both at the state level, the national level, and we do a fair amount of work at the international level as well. But we like to feel that we represent and provide that voice to legislators and regulators across the board to help ensure that seed products are able to be brought to the agriculture community in an efficient and expeditious manner.
I'm wondering what kind of lobbying efforts you would be engaged in on the international front.
Well, as we look at the international front, it's principally dealing with the movement of seed in and out of countries and the ability to move germplasm to improve breeding processes and germplasm analysis. And that's where we spend some of our time in that international arena.
And what kinds of problems do you face coming across borders?
Typically, when you deal with seed, Todd, they're looking at it, or governments are looking at it from the standpoint of the movement of grain for further processing or feed purposes. And seed is not going to be used in that type of a format, and so we have to work with the governments to better understand that this seed is being used for additional breeding to be planted in the future, not to be used in some type of a feeding process or a food production process.
So I suppose one of the things that you have to try to avoid is something that our consumers who travel much outside of the United States will understand, or even if they've gone across the border to Mexico or Canada, that there are always the signs that you can't bring in food or agricultural products.
Yeah, and we're looking to make sure that the products that are being moved don't have weed seeds or noxious weeds or other types of pests also in the product. So it's important that as we move that seed that we've got that good quality and good clean seed moving in and out of the country.
Why does it have to go in and out of the country and in and out of the United States?
Well, there are a lot of places for risk management purposes, Todd. We look to produce seed in places like Chile, like Costa Rica or Puerto Rico that are counter-seasonal to ensure either they'll multiply a parent line or a a crop or to produce seed so that we've got or can ensure that we've got the seed for the growers come planting time. If we're producing all of our seed in one county in Illinois and we had bad weather like we're experiencing some of the areas of the Midwest, we may not be able to supply the demand that's out there. So many of our companies look to produce seeds in other places for that risk management purposes. The other thing that we've seen recently, or especially in the last couple of years, is the cost and availability of land, making sure that we've got that land or space available to produce that seed for further planting down the road or meet the demand of the grower community.
How did biotechnology, the introduction of BT corn, Roundup Ready soybeans in the mid-90s, change, if at all, the way you needed to deal with foreign governments in order to have grow-outs happen in Chile and Argentina and South America?
Well, in looking at that process, companies were able to then go meet with those governments and explain the work, go through the regulatory process they had in their country, or explain the issues that were surrounding the production of those products or those crops down in those countries, and be able to make sure that the regulatory community there was comfortable with bringing in the seed, producing the seed there in that country, and then bringing that seed back to the United States. And it's been a good relationship there in those countries, and I think with the support of the U.S. government and the U.S. regulatory process, they've been very receptive to having companies produce a seed down in their respective countries.
Let's come back to the home nation, Washington, D.C., regulatory process there, and maybe even some of the state regulatory processes. What's on top of the mind at the moment that you're dealing with and trying to make sure the regulations are in place? There are an awful lot of things that are added to the crops now, whether they're genetically modified crops or maybe seed treatments that are available. What's the regulatory process like for the American Seed Trade Association, and what are you lobbying hard for?
Well, the regulatory process has been strong over the years with respect to the approvals and working through the system, the traits that were being brought to commercialization. It's become a little bit of a backlog lately because we've seen more traits coming from the research side into the commercialization side. And so the regulatory process here in Washington, as I said, is a little bit backlogged now. We've got some concerns that the process needs to be bolstered so that the confidence continues to be there in the traits and in the products that are coming to the marketplace. So that's an area that we're working closely with USDA, with our associated industries, whether it's the corn growers, the Soybean Association, and others, to ensure that those products are coming to the market, the new traits, and the opportunity for the farmers to continue to have the choice that's out there. So I would say from the trait standpoint, that's an area that we have some concerns that we are working with the regulatory officials here in Washington, as well as the members of Congress.
When you say bolstered, do you mean streamlined so they come through more quickly, or bolstered so that the regulations in place are there to help ensure that those products are good and safe products, or both?
Well, I would say that they come through the process in an efficient manner, not more quickly, but in an efficient manner, and also that that they are reviewed as they have been to ensure that they meet the requirements of the regulatory process. And so right now there is, as I said, there's a bit of a backlog, so it's not moving through the process as it should. And I wouldn't say at all that it's more streamlined. It's a process that we now have roughly 15 years of good, solid data on traits that are out there, and you're getting second-generation traits coming into the market now too. And so how do you look at those versus the first generation, and can you move those through the process in a different manner than some trait that may be new to the regulatory community? So there are some dynamics that the evolution of the industry in the last couple of years should take into consideration in the regulatory process. And the Department of Agriculture is reevaluating, which they typically do, the regulations on, they typically review biotech regulations as well as all regulations on a regular basis to make sure that they're up to date with technology that's out there. And so they're doing that with the biotech regulatory process at this time.
Nice.
So we hope that that will help better facilitate the movement of traits through the regulatory process.
I understand the need by companies to move things through the regulatory process fairly quickly in order to get an ROI or a return on their investment, because these are large investments. Especially on their second generation, maybe even on their first generation.
Right.
But there was, across the nation in the land grant system, some backlash in when those first products came out, and continues to be some backlash within the land grants, that these products aren't really tested on site at the land grants very much, certainly not before they're released. Are you concerned at all that products that have so much investment in them are coming into the marketplace too quickly without enough scientific review that's by a third party?
Well, Todd, I would first address the issue of it fairly quickly, as you stated there. I don't think as we look at it, it's 8 to 10 years bringing a product to market as you start the regulatory process, and $100 million, roughly $100 million per trade. So, 8 to 10 years through a regulatory process is not fairly quickly as we look at it. So you're starting that clock for your ROI at that time. And with respect to looking at it, the land-grant university system is extremely involved throughout the industry, looking at products prior to commercialization and after commercialization. I think a lot of we've been working with the land-grant university on the university representatives on the concerns that they had with respect to the ability to look at the traits after the commercialization and those kind of things. And there's a lot of dynamics there, Todd, that come into play there, but I think the industry is very comfortable with the products coming into the market and ensuring that the products meet the requirements for the regulatory community, meet the requirements with respect to environmental, anything else that may be there. And the companies stand behind the products that they're bringing to the market. They know that that farmer makes a decision every year to buy seed. And as they're making that claim on what the trait's going to do, the farmer's going to evaluate that on an annual basis to whether it's meeting what the seed company is expressing as the benefit of that specific variety in the trait that's incorporated with it.
Let's take up the technological advances that have come in the last 10 years and then what's out there and available now, and how that aids or speeds up, I suppose, the development of new hybrids, in particular for corn, and new varieties of soybean.
Well, Todd, as we look at it, we've really rapidly increased the ability to analyze plant germplasm for specific traits that are in the various varieties, and use that information to breed stronger, new or improved varieties to provide that base for new hybrids, the introduction of technology or traits, and the use of other innovations to enhance that that product that's being delivered to the farmer. Whether it's the use of molecular marker technology that identifies specific traits that may be included or incorporated into the germplasm in using that in the breeding process, or other analyses, it's enabling the seed industry to bring products to the marketplace in a much more expedited manner.
We're talking this afternoon with the CEO and the president of the American Seed Trade Association. His name is Andy Levine. This is The Farming World from the Urbana-Champaign campus of the University of Illinois, and a production of Illinois Public Media. When we come back, we'll talk a bit about some technological advances and how those are aiding in the breeding process, a bit about why there might be some need for a wide base of germplasm, and maybe we'll take up glyphosate patents as well. More in a moment.
It's National Chocolate Macaroon Day. Like many foods, the origins of the macaroon are murky, but some historians trace it back to an Italian monastery. The pastry became popular in France in the 18th century. It's also St. Morad's Day, patron of wine growers and winemakers. He founded the Monastery of St. Christopher and is said to have lived the whole of each Lent on a single bunch of grapes. On this day in agricultural history, in 1539, Hernando de Soto claimed Florida for Spain. He landed 9 ships, 620 men, and 220 horses at Charlotte Harbor, Florida. In 1841, Nicholas Francis Apparat died. He was inventor of the canning process, preserving food by sealing it in sterilized containers. He published the results of 14 years of research in 1810 and received a 12,000 franc award from French government officials for his efforts. And in 1844, Wilbur Atwater was born. An American scientist, Atwater developed agricultural chemistry. He received a Ph.D. from Yale in 1869 for his studies on the chemical composition of corn, and he established the first agricultural experimental station in the U.S. in 1875. And that's this day in agricultural history.
Support for agricultural information is made possible with support from ADM. ADM thanks America's farmers because everything they do starts with you. Agricultural programs are made possible by First Midwest Bank, serving Illinois' agricultural community with locations in Champaign, Danville, Galesburg, Morris, and McHenry. More information is available from Bob Baisdefer in Danville at 217-477-6016. First Midwest Bank, member FDIC, an equal housing lender.
This is The Farming World from Illinois Public Media. I'm University of Illinois Extension's Todd Gleason. Today we're talking with Andy Levine. He's the CEO and the president of the American Seed Trade Association. Mr. Levine, what's the position of the American Seed Trade Association on developing, finding, and keeping germplasm available for use in the future?
Well, first off, it's great. It's vital to have that strong foundation germplasm to be able to look at the various specific traits and natures of varieties and being able to provide that strong diversity. And we've got to continue to look at doing that, and that's the importance of being able to breed for specific areas, specific agriculture makeups of regions, of sections of counties or sections of states in the demand there. So the seed industry strongly believes that we've got to have that diversity of the germplasm out there and continue to strive to develop it and increase it as we go along, in realizing that we've got to meet the demand of, again, of the farmer for that, his local agronomic issues that impact production in that area. So we have to have that balance. We work closely, again, with the land-grant universities and development of new and improved varieties. We work closely with the USDA Agricultural Research Service and their National Germplasm Repository System. Work closely with Farm Bureau and corn growers on the GEM program, which is the Genetic Enhancement of Maize program that is in the Agriculture Appropriations Bill every year here in Washington, D.C., and we've been able to increase the funding for that. So we realize that diversity has to continue to be there and is just vital for that production and for our production of seed for the farmers.
When you say you work closely with USDA, I understand that's probably in an advisory capacity or talking to them legislatively as a lobbying group. But within the land grant or the university system, researchers, does that mean you're funding projects as well?
Well, actually, through ASTA, we fund a small amount of projects in the corn and soybean side of the industry, as well as the vegetable and flower side of the industry, through these programs we have. Todd, they're not large programs, but our companies all work closely with land grants throughout the area. We've got a large trade show, our corn, sorghum, and soybean meeting that we've been holding for over 40 years in Chicago, the first week of December, and we have great participation from land-grant universities, from researchers and breeders who come in and present on a variety of issues impacting seed, soybean, sorghum, other issues there. And USDA participates in that as well, and we've been getting more and more international participation. So there is, we believe, very strongly in that public-private relationship, and it's vital to continue for the industry in the future.
One final question for you. The Roundup Ready technology patent expires in 2014. What does ASTA have to do with patents, and how do you deal with them?
Well, from our perspective, we're looking at it from that third party as far as the industry and how we work with our industry and how we work with the government to deal with those, that next step of availability of patented products after the patent expires. And so we're looking to have the discussion in the agriculture, I would say, arena with producer organizations that have interest with public institutions, whether it's the land grants, and with the seed companies on that next generation. What would the generic market look like if there's one there? What other issues that may come into play with respect to the patenting process as it evolves through the other the traits, whether it's the Roundup Ready One trait or others as they come off a patent in the next years. So we think we're that organization that can help, obviously with the grower groups, with other industry organizations that represent seed or technology providers as they go forward to have a smooth process in that transition.
Thank you so much for joining us today. We do appreciate you taking the time.
Enjoyed it, Todd, very much.
And that's Andy Levine. He's the CEO and the president of the American Seed Trade Association. You can visit them online at amseed.org. That's amseed.org. You can always visit us online at willag.org, willag.org. I'm Todd Gleason for The Farming World. The Farming World is a production of Illinois Public Media in cooperation with University of Illinois Extension. If you have ideas for programs, please do give us a call. My direct line phone number is 217-333-9697. Call 217-333-9697 or email to willagstaff@illinois.edu.